طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we will continue our coverage of the conference on the Israeli lobby that was held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. last April. We will hear from former AIPAC operative and congressional staffer M.J. Rosenberg, who came to see the light and is now a sharp critic of AIPAC, and former 38-year congressman from West Virginia, Nick Rahal. Exposing the tactics of the Israeli lobby is critical to challenging the mythology and disinformation campaigns that drive the Israeli narrative, and that is exactly what we must be doing to change the attitudes of Americans, particularly in Congress, concerning the Palestine-Israel issue. So first up is M.J. Rosenberg, followed by former Congressman Nick Rahal.
Now, the panelists you're about to hear have been on the front line of the tug of war between Congress and the Israel lobby. Our first panelist, M.J. Rosenberg, is a writer and commentator, primarily on matters relating to Israel. He is a regular contributor to The Nation and Huffington Post, with his writing widely reprinted throughout the world. He has special expertise on the Israel lobby, derived from working for 6 years at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, including 4 as editor of its publication Near East Report, and as senior aide to Executive Director Tom Dine. He also saw AIPAC from the vantage point of Capitol Hill, where he worked for 15 years in the House and Senate. Most recently, he worked for Israel Policy Forum and Media Matters for America. And he made a special effort to be here today. He's been sick. We're very glad he was able to make it, and I know we'll find his insights both fascinating and instructive. So, M.J. Rosenberg.
I have to say I was struck listening to Gideon Levy from Haaretz, that he writes for a major Israeli paper. It's everybody reads Haaretz worldwide, but in Israel itself, and he gets away saying things that he could never say here. If Gideon Levy worked in the United States, the lobby would have him fired. There is no question about that. And that's why when you watch MSNBC and you wait for people that you like who are liberals and progressives to say something good on the Palestinians, they never will. And in that regard, Israel is infinitely ahead of the United States, which means Israel has one really great thing to say about itself. There's no Israel lobby here. And there's just Israel, which is... It just struck me listening to him. He has no equivalent in the United States. Charles Krauthammer. I have a somewhat unique perspective on AIPAC owing to the fact that I was employed there for 6 years as a volunteer for 2 years in the 70s, as a senior staffer in the 80s, but I also did see them from Capitol Hill, where I worked for 15 years for Democratic House members and senators. One of my tasks at AIPAC was writing its manual about Israel and the Arabs, designed to be used as a guide by students, congressional staffers, rabbis, etc., to defend Israel against the lies being told by the other side. It's called Myths and Facts. Although inside of AIPAC it was always called Myths and Myths. You know, myth. This is standard Hasbara. Myth. They say the Palestinians were driven from their homes by the Israeli army in 1948. Fact. the Palestinians actually left their homes in what became Israel in search of better lives in the West Bank and Gaza. That was part of my job, was writing this stuff, but these myths have been around much longer than I've been. I will use the frame myths and facts to address the most common misconceptions about AIPAC as I see them. And I want to clarify at this point, I left AIPAC in 1986, and after that I've only dealt with them from the outside, from Capitol Hill, and you know, not as a staffer. I didn't leave there under bad terms. I wasn't fired from AIPAC. In fact, when I left in 86, it wasn't as right-wing as it subsequently became. So I'm not grinding an axe when you hear my feelings about that organization that was my employer. But the first myth I want to deal with is kind of a pro-AIPAC myth. It is that AIPAC's role in intimidating members of Congress to support its demands through the use of financial pressure and intimidation is unique. That this pressure is an aberration invented by Israel supporters to advance the Israel's government goals. Fact, AIPAC is not an aberration. Basically, every decision Congress makes is made with an eye on who has the money and how can a legislator either get some of it or avoid it being deployed against them. No, not every decision is based on money. But issues like abortion, for instance, which is a religious kind of issue, is not based on money. But everything else is. Most notably issues relating to banks, guns, Wall Street, labor, regulations to protect consumer, health care, the environment, etc. And especially combating any effort to prevent or reduce the effects of climate change. Like when the Koch brothers fight and lobby and use their money to prevent the development of alternative energy sources. I can hardly think of anything that AIPAC does that is less patriotic than the fact that the Koch brothers and their lobby go out there into state legislatures and city councils to make sure that they don't authorize wind farms to allow us to be less dependent on Middle East oil. They don't care about the Middle East oil part. They care about money in their own pocket. That's our system today. Yes, Middle East policy is determined by the highest bidder, which is AIPAC. But pretty much every policy discussed on Capitol Hill is determined by those with the money. If that means that democracy in America is itself a myth, so be it. Because frankly, that is what I believe. It is not just AIPAC that is all about the money. It is everything that comes before Congress. And that's a fact. And I say that for 15 years of being up there and watching it and benefiting from it, too, because you raise money from your bosses from the special interests that want them to do stuff for them. The lobby supporters, of course, argue that it is love for Israel, the supposed fellow democracy that is behind its support. But that was never evident to me. Yes, there are members of Congress who are true believers who, quote, love Israel and are sincerely devoted to its interests as those legislatures or Netanyahu sees those interests. But they are very few. In fact, of the 29 Jewish legislators currently serving, most had little or no involvement with Israel before entering politics, with most making their first visits to Israel as either candidates for office or once they were able to visit on free junkets. Yes, they all talk about loving Israel, about having grown up on Israel, about learning about Israel in Hebrew school, but take it with a grain of salt. Barney Frank, now retired, who was a reliable AIPAC supporter, talked a good game about his love for Israel. But it wasn't intense enough to merit more than one reference in his just-published 300-page autobiography. And he just mentions it in passing with a whole bunch of other countries. Where was Barney's love? It's not in his book. It's not there. Yes, most of the Jews in Congress care about Israel. Most Jews do. But that care would likely lead them to support dovish positions and not mindless hawkishness were it not for the lobby and the financial benefits of staying in its good graces. After all but one of the Jewish members of Congress are Democrats and liberals who hold dovish views on every other foreign policy issue except Israel, where for some reason they become raving hawks. Same with non-Jewish Democratic supporters of Israel. Same thing. Honestly, can anyone believe that Bernie Sanders really believed that the Gaza war was a good idea? Or Elizabeth Warren? Or Al Franken? Or any of the other big-time progressive types who supported it or at the very least refused to condemn it? Not even expressing a word of sympathy for the killing of kids on a beach. They couldn't say it. If you watch, there are tapes. You see them on YouTube of Bernie Sanders screaming at constituents who brought up the slaughter in Gaza and Elizabeth Warren literally running away from a constituent who asked a question. The same applies to the Democrats who are joining Republicans to fight the Iran agreement. These are people who always favor diplomacy over war and certainly who support their Democratic president, especially when it comes to a diplomatic breakthrough like this. But not this time. At this point, we don't know how many Democrats will fight Obama on lifting Iran sanctions, but it may be enough to override his veto. Just think about that. Congressmen voting to override a veto by a president from their own party. Why would they do that? The answer is that their position on this issue of war and peace is dictated by their determination to please AIPAC donors. Chuck Schumer deserves special mention here. The next leader of Democrats in the Senate. His rise to the majority leader post, or minority, whatever it is going to be when he comes in, majority or minority leader, does not stem only from his charm, brilliance, or ability to place himself in front of television cameras. It comes from his ability to raise money from his base, which is viewed as, and in fact is, Wall Street and pro-Israel donors. Schumer no more loves Israel than he loves Wall Street. But he loves the money that these two sources provide to his campaign coffers. And through his efforts as the Democratic Senate as chair of the Democratic Campaign Committee to his colleagues in the Democratic Party itself, he became head of the campaign committee, would raise money from AIPAC, raise money from Wall Street, and then dole it out to all his friends in the party who are up for re-election. And then they know where it comes from. This is important to note. Pro-Israel donors and AIPAC give so much money to candidates that the Democratic Party has for years been choosing only those closest to the lobby to run their campaign fundraising operations. That is why Rahm Emanuel got to be chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, putting him both in place to block any candidate not sympathetic to AIPAC from running, which he did. He also blocked Arab Americans from running for Congress. And to grease his ascent to the top. And that is why ambitious Democrats will do all they can to defeat Obama on Iran. It's good for business. As the song goes, what's love got to do with it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Of course, there are the Christian conservatives who do love Israel or say they do. Today, a large part of that love is, in fact, motivated by hatred of Barack Obama. Netanyahu has made himself President Obama's enemy, so conservative Republicans love him. And many love him in Israel for sincere reasons, religious or because they view Israel as a bulwark against the Muslims. Unlike legislators on the left, however, they are not hypocrites when it comes to Israel. I have nothing good to say about John McCain, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, or the rest of them, but their views on Israel fits in with their worldview, which is that force works and diplomacy never does. Their support for Israel up till now has not been bought because it didn't have to be bought. Although, according to this past Sunday's New York Times, Republicans are now joining Democrats in terms of getting paid for their devotion to Israel, something Senator Tom Cotton discovered when he wrote his letter to the president of Iran and was paid $1 million. He probably does not need AIPAC money to win re-election in Arkansas, but the Harvard-educated veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan has his sights set higher than that. His devotion to the cause will certainly help him get there and has already. In general, though, the conservatives don't matter much. on matters relating to Israel. One, even for the most zealous defender of Israel in the Republican caucus, Israel is not central to them or their fundraising. Not central to the way fighting against gays or abortions or Obama or illegal immigration. Those are all their big issues. Yes, there is Sheldon Adelson and a few others who give money to right-wing candidates, but given that 80% of Jews are Democrats, as are the overwhelming majority of Jewish donors, these Christian conservatives are pretty insignificant in terms of the big picture. In all my years on Capitol Hill, I never heard a single staff member say that they had to vote for some Palestinians don't exist resolution that was on the House floor because they're afraid of the Christians. No, they're afraid of AIPAC, and AIPAC is not a Christian organization. The fear is awesome to behold. In 2006, this is amazing, the White House and the Israeli government agreed on an $86 million aid package for the Palestinian Authority to strengthen the PA to help it withstand the Hamas threat. I remember talking to the leading Democrat on the House Appropriation Committee. She had heard from the Israeli government that they wanted this $86 million to go to the Palestinians, and that they, in fact, had drawn up the package with the State Department. So she said, that being the case, she'll support it. Next thing I heard, she was opposing it. In fact, she said she would cut the sum in half, which she did. I paid her another call. Why had she changed her mind with the president and the Israeli prime minister in agreement behind it? She said, after she spoke to me about it, she met with a senior AIPAC lobbyist who told her to cut it in half. I asked her why, and she said, they don't think it's the right time. So it's not just the United States government that Israel is stronger than. It's the Israeli government, too. Now, this legislator has a safe seat, but like Schumer, she was always in the fundraising business for herself, for other candidates, and she also became head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Her loyalty was not to Israel, but to AIPAC itself. After all, the Israeli government may be calling the shots, but it is AIPAC that is coordinating the PACs, and far more important than the PACs, the individual donors. A lot more money goes to members of Congress from individual donors than from PACs. I saw in the news the other day that Congressman Chris Van Hollen, who is running for and likely to win the Democratic nomination for senator from Maryland, has raised $1 million for his Senate campaign and has $2 million more in the bank. That would not be the case had he not changed his tune on Israel. Back in 2006, Chris Van Hollen got into deep hot water with the lobby when he criticized Israel's conduct of the war with Hezbollah. He expressed support for Secretary Condoleezza Rice's statement that Israel was not taking care to avoid civilian casualties. Poor Chris. He was new then, didn't know that such an audacious stand, expressing support for his own Secretary of State, would cause the lobby to go nuts. But it did. He was summoned to explain himself to the Jewish Community Council of Greater Washington, the local branch of the lobby, which he did. And then he issued a statement which retracted his statement. Or his earlier statement, but his mea culpas were not accepted. So they insisted that he go to Israel and do his repentance there. And he did. The lobby's type still didn't trust him, but now, a decade later, with Chris Van Hollen demonstrating his devotion, he is the lobby's candidate, with his opponent, Representative Donna Edwards, assigned the former Chris Van Hollen role of Israel critic. Last week, he said he was asked by the Baltimore Jewish paper why he had ever done that in 2006. What were you thinking? He said there was a situation where there were some differences with the community. The goals were the same. They're always the same, which is to ensure the safety of Israel. We have shared values, shared priorities. And this issue, that's going to be one of the biggest issues in Maryland, is in the primary, is going to be that Donna Edwards is an enemy of Israel, the Jewish people, and all. None of it's true. But this, and Chris Van Hollen, who has the same views as she does, he smartly insulated him against them by making all his apologies. That is the way it's been for the past 30 years. That may be changing or not, something we will not know until we see how the effort to roll back the Iran agreement goes. The Iran agreement is something the Israelis and the lobby will not tolerate, which is why they're going to the mat to defeat this deal. If they succeed in defeating the agreement, and simultaneously President Obama, with the support of two-thirds of Congress that they induced to support Netanyahu, they will be viewed correctly as stronger than ever. They never brought down a president before. This will be a first. If, however, Obama succeeds in putting over this agreement, the lobby will be badly damaged, not only because they lost, but because in the process they are exposed as an ally of right-wing Republicans, not the bipartisan organization they claim to be. With the polls showing that Israel itself is increasingly out of favor with the Democratic base, they could be on the road to extinction. But we can't know that now. I can say, however, that I'm optimistic, but not too optimistic. Let me conclude by congratulating American Educational Trust and the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy for convening this incredibly timely conference. Back when I first started AIPAC, Steve Rosen, who was my boss and was later indicted for espionage against the United States, he's still around, though. You're allowed to get indicted for espionage. Depends who you're doing it for. He sent me a now-famous memo. It's now famous because I gave it to the Washington Post. He warned me not to ever talk. This is my second day there. Never to talk about AIPAC activities outside the lobby. He wrote, "A lobby is a night flower. It thrives in the dark and shrivels up in the sunlight." I think that may be happening now thanks to all our efforts. If it does, not only the United States, but Israel, the Palestinians, and the world will be better off. This night flower needs crushing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, MJ. Our next two panelists are former members of Congress who did not stay in the good graces of the Israel lobby. And there's a third one here in the audience today that I'd like to recognize. It's Representative Jim Moran of Virginia, who just retired. Thank you. Now, our next speaker was first elected to Congress at the age of 27, becoming its youngest member. Democrat Nick Rahal, a grandson of Lebanese immigrants, represented West Virginia from 1977 until January of this year. Not only has he repeatedly expressed concern about America's relationship with Israel, but he was one of only 8 House members to vote against the authorization for use of military force in 2002 that preceded the Iraq War. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Janet. I appreciate that introduction. I want to thank you and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, Andy Kilgore, your publisher and founder, Delinda Hanley, Grant Smith, and also the Institute for Research Middle East Policy for putting together this very important conference and for all the work that has gone into making this a success that it is. I want to also recognize a dear friend besides my former colleague Jim Moran that's already been recognized, but another dear friend of all of us that's in the room, the Arab League Ambassador Mohammed Al-Hassani, who's sitting right here on the front row. Mr. Ambassador, good to see you. Wow, after that previous speaker, I guess I'm going to be kind of tame. And my former colleague, Paul Findlay, as well, from whom you're going to hear, but it's so good to see you again, Paul, and to have met your son here as well. My first encounter with the Israeli lobby. Wow, it didn't take long to think about that, because shortly after I was elected to Congress in 1977, I, along with a couple of other of my colleagues, went to the Middle East. Several in the delegation, Toby Moffat, Mary Rose Okar, were of Lebanese ancestry, as I am. And we put Lebanon first on our itinerary. The word got out pretty soon that we were going to Lebanon first. Wow. The lobby swung into action. Don't you know, we know you're a new member of Congress, but don't you know nobody goes to the Middle East without going to Israel first? And then we'll make sure you get into Lebanon or wherever else you want to go. Now, we said no. We had made an executive decision, And we decided, no, we're going to go to Lebanon first, the land of our grandfathers, and that's what we did. Well, that was my first encounter. Things didn't get much better after that. A couple years later, 1982, Israel starts bombing Lebanon, ostensibly to rid the country, the PLO, and to free its border from shelling from PLO terrorists into Israel. Okay, went on a while. It became pretty clear to myself that this was going a little bit beyond than just ridding southern Lebanon of the PLO when bombs started falling in Beirut. So I took to the floor of the House, made the press back in my home district and everything, pretty critical of Israel, that Errol Sharon, then a defense minister, was out of control, that Israel was acting like a monster and wanting to take over not just southern Lebanon, but all of Lebanon. And my statements got press. Speaker of the House, then Tip O'Neill, came to me and said, Nick, I want you to lead a congressional delegation and go to Beirut and whatever countries in the Middle East you want. I'll give you the plane and come back and give us all a report. I said, yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm honored you would invite me to do that. So we had a CODEL that July, end of July 1982. I was the chairman, Mary Rose Okar, a member, Merv Dimley, the late Merv Dimley from California, David Bonnier, who later became majority whip of the House of Representatives, Pete McCloskey, you'll recall all of these members, Paul, and Elliot Levitas, Jewish member from Georgia. We took off. We ended up, our whole itinerary covered six countries, meeting with five heads of state. The only one we did not meet with was the King of Jordan, who was unavoidably out of the country at the time. But we went into Lebanon, and we were able to meet with Chairman Arafat in the bowels of Beirut at the end of July with Israeli bombs falling all over the place. Several different rendezvous during the course of a 24-hour period to escape our State Department escorts, who were wanting to make sure we didn't do such silly stuff against U.S. law. They kept warning us, you can be in prison for meeting with Arafat, blah, 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 blah. And we went on with it anyway. We came out of that meeting about 4 a.m. that night, and all the press of the world was there waiting for us. They had already heard about the meeting. Chairman Arafat signed a piece of paper that we put in front of him that said he recognized all U.N. resolutions relevant to the Palestinian question. It's debatable. It's debatable then. It's been debatable since whether that really meant recognition of Israel or not. I thought and still think it did, although it may have taken a couple years later for him to formally do that, two-state solution recognized, etc. But when we came back home, the Speaker, of course, very much interested in a report on our trip. We met with him. We met with officials of the White House, briefed them, National Security Council, etc. Well, four of my colleagues will remain nameless at this point, but they introduced a resolution on the floor of the House to impeach those of us that met with Arafat for treason. For treason. New York Post ran our picture, front page, most wanted, with the most ugly mugshots they could find of the four of us that met with Arafat. Now, Elliot Levitas, rather, did not meet with Arafat. Although the next day we had meetings scheduled with Menachem Begin and Defense Minister Errol Sharon. When the worldwide press hit, we just met with Arafat the night before, they immediately canceled. Elliot Levitas got on the phone to Menachem Begin's office and said, listen, Mr. Prime Minister, this is a Jewish member of Congress. I don't care who my colleagues met with yesterday. You're going to continue your appointment with them, and you're going to meet with them, or you'll have trouble from this Jewish member of Congress when I get back home. Menachem Begin, Defense Minister Sharon, put us back on their schedule. We met with them. Going into Errol Sharon's office, it became a shouting match right off the bat. We questioned him on the use of cluster bombs against agreements with the United States when they were using those bombs for offensive purposes rather than defensive purposes. And one thing that struck me right off the bat was a map on the wall in Errol Sharon's office. There was no Lebanon. There was no Jordan. There were no boundaries at all. It was all Israel. Scary. Really scary. So fast forward a couple years. We got through 82. I went back later that year with the late Jack Murtha to view our peacekeeping forces when we were truly peacekeeping forces at the end of 82, when we were there to evacuate the innocent PLO, or all the PLO actually, from Lebanon to as part of an agreement. But fast forward to the years of Oslo, 93, things looked pretty good. I was invited to go with President Clinton, actually in 98 after Oslo, with him to Palestine, to Gaza, when he was the first U.S. president to set foot on Palestinian soil. We opened the Gaza airport. We met with Arafat. President Clinton spoke to the Palestinian National Council. Arafat spoke right after him. It was all hunky-gory. Everything was great. That evening in the suite of the Camp David, when we had our nightly meeting to find out what all we did during the course of the day, President Clinton was scheduled to address the Knesset the next day. He puts his arm around me and he says, "Nick," and Sandy Berger is right there on one side and Madeleine Albright on the other side. He says, "I'm feeling a little bad. I'm wondering if you'll give my address to the Knesset tomorrow." I thought Madeleine Albright was going to have a heart attack. The president, of course, was kidding. Then in 95, my experience with the Israeli lobby. I get a letter of invitation to go to Israel, May of 1995, with AIPAC. I look at the letter, do a couple double takes. I say, this can't be real. I ask my staff, please verify that this letter came from AIPAC and that this individual really signed the invitation. They checked it out and came back and said, "Boss, this letter is a real invite. It's not a hoax." I said, "Okay, I'm going to accept. I'll go." I think AIPAC was just as surprised I accepted as I was that they'd invited me. But I did go on that trip, and I said under one condition, and that is that I can sneak over to Gaza, go over to Gaza any way I want to, in order to meet with Chairman Arafat. They thought about it for a couple of days and came back and said, "Yes, that's fine." I don't think they believed I was really going to do it. We get in Tel Aviv the night before I'm scheduled to go into Gaza to meet with Arafat. AIPAC finds out I'm serious. I'm really going over the next day to meet with Arafat. So that night, a couple members of the AIPAC's board comes to me and says, "Hey, Nick, can we go over with you? Can we go with you?" So I made some calls, and yes, it was agreed. And the next day, several members of the board of directors of AIPAC went with Nick Rahal to meet with Yasser Arafat in Gaza. And they were just stumbling over themselves to get their pictures taken with him after our meeting ended up. Of course, things after that's all history and it's gone downhill. But the lobby, you know, much has been said about the lobby, the Jewish lobby. And it's just so massive and so all-inclusive that it's hard to put the finger on one individual as back over the previous years. I'm going to get to the present day in a moment. But it's hard to define any one group. And, that, of course, that's their goal. And let me say a word about lobbies. It's part of our small-d democratic system of government in this country. Any ethnic group, Jewish, Arab, Greek, Italian, Spanish, has the right to organize and petition their government for a redress of their grievances. Democratic right. I have no problem with that. Where my problem comes in is when those lobbies put the interests of the country, foreign country, from which they come, ahead of the interests of the United States of America and not registered as a foreign agent, which is also required by our laws of the United States. So to lobby is fine. MJ's mentioned the many different lobbies that exist here and the way in which members of Congress react, and I don't deny a bit of that. But I think in the case of the Israeli, the Jewish lobby, they are so many light years ahead of all the others. There may be disagreements within the various groups that comprise the Jewish lobby. There are disagreements, I'm sure. But the public image is presented as one unified voice. The Arab lobby, light years behind. There's many different groups across this town and across America that represent various Arab groups. They have different agendas, whether it's to fight discrimination, whether it's to lobby to get Americans of Arab descent elected, whether it's to lobby the Congress of the United States, whatever the goal. They're all worthy and good goals. But there's disagreements, and those disagreements between those groups often hit the press much more than disagreements within Jewish lobbying organizations. And, of course, as the ambassador knows, there's disagreements in the Arab world among Arab countries. And, unfortunately, that hurts the Arab message, if there is one, when it comes to lobbying the Congress or changing American public opinion. We're making progress, yes. I think the more and more that the media comes around to demonstrating what's happening on the ground in the Middle East, the more Americans and legislators travel to the Middle East, not with AIPAC, but in an objective fashion, and see the facts on the ground, the more, at least privately, minds are changing in this city and on Capitol Hill. And note I said the word privately. So there are groups that lobby in this town that put America's best interests first. And that is my biggest concern when it comes to the Jewish lobby. There are too many times, and certainly the Mersheimer and Walt report of 2006, we all recall that report on lobbying of the lobby in this country, gives numerous examples of where American politicians' minds have been changed when they perhaps almost stepped over that line or maybe even did step over that line and criticized Israel and maybe even used the words my good friend Paul Finley has used, which is, let's have an objective American foreign policy that allows Americans to be objective so they can bring the sides together to reach a comprehensive peace. But that, as we know, has been a trip word that has caused many a politician to run amok of the lobby and therefore have to retract and have to do what has been described that a certain candidate for Senate in Maryland has just been doing recently. Today, ever since 2010, in the Citizens United decision by our illustrious George Bush-appointed Supreme Court, the way lobbying is done, the way campaign expenditures are amassed, is quite different. Today we have unregulated and undisclosed humongous amounts of money being spent in political campaigns. The U.S. Supreme Court and Citizens United opened that up through the Freedom of Speech Clause. Now, I have no problem with freedom of speech. What I have a problem with is the undisclosed nature of that decision whereby these monies can be given to these independent expenditure groups and nobody will ever know who gave the money to those groups. Now, when we ran our personal campaigns, every penny coming in had to be reported. Every penny going out had to be reported. But not so with these independent expenditures. And by the very nature of their being legal, they cannot be pro any candidate. They have to be anti, thereby lending so much more to the negativity of our campaigns today and the dysfunctionality and the polarization of Congress after the elections. This is certainly one of the biggest factors in that dysfunctionality is this Citizens United decision. It's anti, whether it's the incumbent or a challenger, and the person that benefits from all that negativity never has to report a penny on his or her campaign expenditure or from where or anything about the millions of dollars of ads ran against their opponent. What do we know? That lends to the question, what does that person stand for who benefits from all the negative against the other person? We don't know. Never does that person have to say what he or she stands for. So what we've seen is a hijacking of our democracy by these outside independent expenditures. There's front groups, of course. Like in my case in this past election, the front group was Americans for Prosperity, AFP. The public name associated with AFP are the Koch brothers. Their total expenditure in my congressional race was probably $14 million by most reports. That includes all of the independent expenditures and my opponent's spending as well. And again, we have no idea where the money for the AFP Americans for Prosperity, or the Prosperous, whatever you want to call it. We have no idea who gave to them. I don't know whether it was my co-operator's money. I highly suspect it. I don't know whether Sheldon Adelson's money was involved. I highly suspect it, although he had his own separate group that he gave to called the Young Guns that was a major part of the Republican operation last November. So what we've seen now are these billionaires, whether the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and others, and there's billionaires on the Democratic side. I don't mean to paint this all as one side. But these billionaires using these dark money expenditures have actually dwarfed AIPAC. I mean, they've made AIPAC look like a little lamb pauper going around the street asking for money these days. And the perfect example of how I think they're controlling the strings of the Congress was, first of all, this year, the invitation to the Prime Minister of Israel to address Congress without State Department okay, without White House okay, and 2 weeks before a domestic political campaign in the state of Israel. Inviting the Prime Minister to come give a political speech before the Congress of the United States 2 weeks before his toughest reelection of his life. What was that followed up by? A letter signed by 47 senators to Iran, not to the president of our country, but to Iran, expressing their deepest problems with what even is not even a deal now of a U.S.-Iran nuclear arms control agreement. And I want one as much as the Israelis. Believe you me, I don't want to see Iran develop nuclear weapons. And I have the same concern a lot of our allies in the region have. But by golly, you don't do it, as been described already today, by continuing to spread fear. We saw what happened when Ariel Sharon and George Bush, the son, did that in Iraq. It's Iraq all over again. The falsification of what the threat is, and certainly Iran is not an existential threat to the United States, and it may be to Israel. I'm not going to debate Israel politics on that. But there we find Israel and United States interests diverging, and they're not one and the same. We can deal with Iran in a little different perspective than can Israel. And we should not have 47 United States senators sending a letter to Iran trying to tell them what the Congress of the United States is going to do and how they're going to override the president, because this is just not in our best interest, in my opinion. Now, the fact that these signers, the fact that the gentleman from Arkansas, the originator of this letter, been in the Senate, 49 days? I guess he knows everything about the world. But anyway, the fact that he had to deny that this letter was cooked up in a suite of Sheldon Adelson's in Nevada, the fact that he even had to deny that publicly, I think speaks something, too, about where the origins of this letter really came from. There again, we see a hijacking of our democracy in this country by billionaires intent on controlling the Republican leadership of this Congress that is so disheartening, disconcerting, disastrous, damnable to the best interests of the United States of America and to our foreign policy. It leads other countries to say, what's going on in the United States? Are they trusting the Prime Minister of a foreign country before they're trusting the word of their own President of the United States? And how can we trust the United States? I mean, just think about what a message that is. And getting back to the Koch brothers, and MJ referenced this when he talked about how they wanted to feed everything other than, I don't think he quite said this, but I'll say it, other than what is oil-based. Here they come into West Virginia, and me being the most pro-coal Democratic member of Congress in the Congress of the United States, and they run a campaign against me being anti-coal, as if they're pro-coal, when you know the real reason is they're pro-oil and gas. That's where they made their money, so why shouldn't they be after the most pro-coal Democrat in the United States Congress? Their own hidden agendas, their own profits is what's running this. And again, I think, is frightening for the future of democracy in this country. So let me try to say one last word about the lobby and to say that it would appear that the mere existence of the lobby and all its ramifications in this country suggests that unconditional support for Israel, unconditional support, the blank check mentality, the Pavlovian reflex of so many in the Congress toward Israel, is not in America's national interest. If it was, why would one need such an well-organized, well-oiled special interest group to bring it about? So I conclude by saying, once again, I want to thank everybody that has put this conference together. I think you have provided a forum for some thought-provoking ideas, some debate, certainly much more debate on the question, probably in this one day than I've seen in my 38 years on the floor of the House of Representatives. But at least the debate is there. Thank each of you.
That was former AIPAC operative and congressional staffer M.J. Rosenberg and former Congressman Nick Rahol of West Virginia speaking at the Conference on the Israeli Lobby held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. last April. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next Sunday and every Sunday to hear the Palestinian point of view. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.